you're talking about. I have a group question. Can I interrupt? Is this roundtable supposed to accomplish anything, or is it just is it just schmooze time?
Trade ideas and ask questions, I guess.
Okay. Trade ideas.
That's yeah. You know.
Yeah. Cool.
Maybe those who have questions first. Those that came here that want to learn from. Well, we all want to learn from each other.
Yeah.
Who is the moderator?
Todd had some ideas that came up out of a workshop and I'm talking about things yesterday at an open source about setting up stations with, and I'm going to should let him talk, setting up stations with a kind of a standard computer setup.
Can I back up 1 second?
Yeah, go.
Who here doesn't know much about radio technology and engineering and stuff like that?
We learn.
Yeah, I just wanted to see. I mean, and then everybody else, I recognize faces and names.
This is the divide, right?
Yeah, right. The haves and haves not. I don't mean to, like, hijack this or anything, but do you folks as neophytes or new to this have specific questions that you want to talk about, or did you just want to sort of gather information as it was talked about?
I want to take a question regarding automated software, but people use it and they see.
So, I'm going to continue interrupting. There's a whole session tomorrow on automation.
Yeah.
But we can certainly talk about your question here. Yeah, absolutely. I didn't want to sidetrack you.
And one of the first choices is what platform.
Yeah.
And there are strong opinions on all
sides.
I have a question for my manager. I have no idea about the technology, but the manager of my station wanted me to ask fine people about using regular cable internet to link the studio and a transmitter as opposed to microwave or fiber optic. He wants to know how reliable it is. So can you address that issue?
It can be extremely reliable. It depends somewhat.
It's as reliable as the provider.
That's pretty much it. I've set up a few using internet as the STL. And
I don't know what SGL is.
STL, studio transmitter link.
Okay.
Studio transmitter link. It's getting your audio from the studio to the transmitter. And
it's as reliable as fiber optic? Or microwave?
No. Well, no. Generally, no.
You can't afford a fiber link.
Well, we have a fiber optic link now, I think.
No, what?
Use it.
No. So stay with it.
To the other end. Yeah.
Something like a Verizon Fios type of thing.
I believe. I'm not sure if it was Fios or not, but.
I think we
paid to run the cable up there, if I remember right. Up to our tower.
Oh, you already have done it.
I think so. So you're saying to stay with the fiber optic?
Well, my first question always is, do you have line of sight to your transmitter from your studio? Okay. Then it's worth looking into other options. With going through the internet, it's you're always going to have bit reduction. You're not going to get linear, full 110% fidelity. But you can get darn close to it.
You can get far beyond FM quality.
And those that do this a lot seem to think that getting at least 320 kilobit AAC is about as transparent as you can get at that bit rate. Using a cheap Barracks box at 128 kilobit MP3 will be very disappointed with. So.
Yeah. Well, I would say even more important than bit rate over the internet is latency and reliability, dropouts. I mean, especially on a cable system, which is a shared cable systems, unless the cable operator is using fiber optic, if they're using coaxial cable, it's a shared broadcast domain. And so you actually run, and I mean broadcast in a computer networking term, not a radio broadcasting term. So you actually share that cable medium with your physical neighbors. So unless your cable operator is giving you a fiber line, you've got reliability issues that you have to contend with.
Are quality of service guarantee QoS worth their weight on paper at all? Or
they can be. If
did the
yeah,
it seems like some of them perform and others just seem to ignore it. So
if you can hold your operator to them,
yeah,
they're not cheap though.
Yeah, you pay for that.
And the other thing you have is the T1 line, which WGXC's T1 line has been horribly unreliable.
Hmm. And they're expensive.
Yeah,
really
yeah.
Too,
I wouldn't even recommend a T1 anymore because they're so expensive.
But it's pretty old technology.
A lot of places don't offer it anymore. Yeah.
Well, a lot of times they have this thing that they call a T1, which is really
a modem on each end, and they're just sending it over.
Well, in a way, but it supposedly has guaranteed bandwidth. But the problem that they had is essentially guaranteed operation.
The session yesterday, the consensus seemed to be if you can somehow stick with one provider from end to end, you got a much better chance of success.
Yeah,
because it never leaves their network.
And if it's LPF, is it LPFM or full power?
No, we're full power.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you have to cross into another company's domain, that's when it really starts. The
call
really starts
plummeting. Pretty strong up there. I think that Verizon carries the line all the way up.
You want to make one call if there's a problem.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure it's Verizon. But we have a satellite studio over in Pennsylvania, which is about 30 miles away from our home station.
Yeah.
And I think that goes over the internet, and I don't think I've heard any dropouts on that.
Are you in an urban or rural area?
Rural. Yeah, we're in the Catskill.
Can you think of a two-hop solution in which there would be line of sight? Because Tom and I have done very successful two-hops with very inexpensive microwave that are surprisingly affordable.
And are they, and the quality is good on a microwave?
Oh, yeah. Fantastic quality. Fantastic quality.
Well, I've never recommended an internet STL. I mean, they've all been catastrophes, every one that I've ever built at one point or another. But two hops, I mean, it's just like two internet cables.
They've all been problematic, but sometimes it's all you can do.
But you have to get permission on somebody's property to be able to hop that over.
Yeah, you need to.
And you've got to have power.
We did one in Puerto Rico where the first hop was like a half a mile. The second one was 15 miles over water, which we were nervous about. But it's gone fine for more than a year now, and it's been flawless.
If you use a barracks box for...
It was very inexpensive.
...or a codec, right? There's other forms of modulation that you can put on it, other than MP3 that will sound quite a bit better.
On Barracks?
Well, we went linear PCM. I think Barracks' MP3 is crap.
Yeah,
it's crap.
It's terrible.
Do not use it. If you can't use their linear PCM, I'd use anybody else's box.
Vorbis 192K is higher quality than FM.
What is?
I challenge any radio engineer.
And who makes the best codecs for that, then?
Odd Vorbis.
What's
said?
That piece of equipment again?
Yeah,
you've got to build it yourself.
Yeah, build it yourself.
Doing make
build
it
yourself.
You've got to make
it. I'll
build
it
for you.
All right. Odd
Vorbis. Now, the one
use 192. That's an average.
Yeah, but
I want to bring this up, actually.
It's higher quality than
I agree.
Can we have one person talk at a time?
I would love to see a computer-based solution with STLs like that has the robustness of a battery. Because I've had plenty of people say, yeah, I can put up a screen for you in Odd Vorbis, but like then the computer needs an update, or the power goes out and it doesn't default back to the right place. The great thing about the Barracks is that you unplug them and they go right back where they started.
I've had one running for about 4 years.
Almost always. Thank you. Almost always.
And
okay.
Survived,
so tell them you're up.
Yeah.
And it also survives. It doesn't like every like. You know, 3 months, they have a little box that says, are you ready for an update?
No, it's been working fine for years. And another thing about it is that since it goes over internet, and some of it is supposedly dedicated lines, but they actually have a setup with multiple internets, so that if one internet link drops, it automatically switches over and feeds a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been working for 3.5 years.
Yeah, I really would look into a two-hop.
You'll, after the first year, there will be money ahead.
Do you have like the software set up for it? Like something that you just like put on a USB stick and you just stick it into both sides?
I've been thinking of doing it.
I have a name.
I've got
Dark
a system for WDRT that's pretty close to that. I haven't. Nobody's ever asked me to replicate it, but it would be pretty easy to replicate.
That would be great.
Yeah,
I think that would be very
nice. Well, and that's one of the things that a subgroup of this crowd has been talking about is come up with either a CD or a USB stick that contains all those pieces, and you find yourself some hardware, which this we have a document that we're starting to work on, and I guess I would welcome all kinds of input to this. But, it's a replicable and repeatable and stable, robust solution that includes pretty much, I think, exclusively open source. Mm-hmm.
I've set up in several places. Essentially, I pretty much have a standard setup with involving Linux and Linux and some applications that I would set up the same computer and use it in a number of different applications. You might turn one thing on or off, but it's all there, and I might have a radio station with 10 computers in it. All 10 are set up identically, and they may be used in different things, and part of the setup is you plug it in and it streams. And the ones that I've done, the streaming is based on Dark Ice and Icecast, and it's been working for years.
So are you saying your back nine are your plan B? You've got 10 computers, one goes down?
No, what I'm saying is that I got one in Studio A, I got another one in Studio B, I have one at the transmitter, I have one in the office, and they all have the same stuff installed on them, but depending on where they're sitting, you may or may not be using it all. But it's kind of neat having that because, one computer might be a server which has the automation database on it, and if I want to upload files to the automation system, I can do it from the office because it has all the software on it. And this particular setup actually has Outpost Studios, and so we have another one in an Outpost Studio, and on a schedule, it rsyncs the automation, and so we have studios that are located miles apart that actually share the entire automation music library and PSA library and all of that stuff.
I'm going to jump in on two things. One is on the barracks boxes. My feeling has always been that at the receive end, the barracks box is the perfect tool. You can't duplicate it. It's small, it's robust, it's bulletproof, it resyncs when the power goes off. But at the transmit end, you can actually use anything you want. Yeah. And I think the way barracks' pricing model is where the receive boxes are actually cheaper than their encoder boxes, you know, I would just build Linux PC, you know, with a $25 throwaway from the surplus store, and have that be the send, and but then have one of the $325 or whatever that we're charging for now barracks boxes at the receive end. I think that to me is the ideal solution for an internet based.
Yes.
Can you have a simple setup
on the MP3?
Yes. Yeah.
What's so special about receive
it? Because it's a little box, it's this big, it restarts automatically, it's very small, power consumption.
What's special about it is that the difficulty is on the encode end.
Yes.
And the receive end is simple, and they haven't boxed it like the encode end.
I mean, a person could do that really easily.
With the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could. Yeah. I mean, that's basically the barracks boxes before Raspberry Pi existed.
And then the other thing about it is that, getting back to this setup that I was talking about where it switches, where the STL actually switches over to a different link, is that if you got a barracks box, you're essentially setting it to one link. And the way this automatic backup works is that if the primary stream drops, there's a second URL that it switches over to.
So you have your barracks box running off of a router, which is homed into two separate internets and has two DNSs, and then whichever one fails, it automatically
falls. Yeah, you can do things like that. But
the barracks does that automatically.
The barracks can do that right built in.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to just address the thing about the two hop SDL micro for a second. What we found is that going over water is incredibly weather dependent. That if you live in the northern Midwest and you're in the fall or the spring, that microwave actually bends over the lake. But in the summertime, it shoots straight. And so we had a problem with ours where we had a hop like that, and it was bending and it was causing interference to itself. That is, it was the one.
Multipath or whatever.
Yeah, it's called multipath. And so we ended up getting rid of the hop. But the lake was what was doing it, and it was only doing it seasonally. So in Puerto Rico, where your temperature is probably pretty consistent, you won't have that, but you might have it if you're
in the ocean type.
There are ways of adjusting that when you're shooting over water. First of all, you can take. Watch your AGC and take your dish and start tilting it up, right? So that you're getting less of your signal going down and reflecting off of the water and going up, right? And the way you do that, you take your dish and you start tilting it up until your AGC starts dropping off, and then come back just a tad, right? And there's other ways of dealing with that, too. If you have vegetation in front of you that can shroud the dish from seeing the water, right, that'll help a lot, too.
That was the other thing we found, by the way, was this fall, winter, spring problem when the trees leaped up and the leaves got full of water.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, that absorbs more signal the more water you get on it. But the other thing, I just lost it here.
Being tilted vegetation in the water.
And frequency? What depends what frequency you're using?
Well, that's a factor. I mean, you get different reflection off of the water. The other thing is, if the water is choppy, right, and it's not real smooth, you won't get any reflection off of it. So if you're in an area where the wind is blowing all the time, the water is probably not going to be much of a problem.
The ocean is never glass.
And for
like
frequency,
a lake might be, yeah.
We're talking 950 megahertz here, right? Is that what you guys use now?
No, these are 5.8 lengths.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
something? Well, that was the frequency question. And also, I'm pushing for somebody to develop the OpenOB system for all of us so I can understand and use it.
Open
outside broadcast. If you look for OpenOB on Google and James Harrison, you'll get there. It's on GitHub. It's an open source system. There's guys from the BBC who do this in their spare time and for their community radio stations. They use it for STL, they use it for live remotes. They've got it to run on Raspberry Pis, which is these tiny cheap computers, or on the BeagleBoards. BeagleBoard Black seems to be a really good one. And so it's a really cheap, solid link, uses Opus as the codec, which is a newer. You found it?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
James Harrison dot
He posts on PopTech. He seems to be a real bright.
There's a whole
young
bunch on
Brit.
GitHub.
And I tried to install it on a computer. He actually helped me, but then I kind of ran out of time and I never finished.
Much technology, so little time.
And it has very little delay. So if you're looking for a two-way conversation on a live remote, that's you know, the stream is nice. It's solid. If you want to use MP3 or OGG, you get a lot of delay.
Some of that delay is actually deliberate.
And some of it is good. Yeah, increases reliability. But you know, it's 10 seconds after noon, and people don't get the stream until 30 seconds later. Well, that's kind of wrong.
Well, that's another thing to talk about. Using the internet, there's always going to be a long delay.
Is that a problem? Like you're doing a remote broadcast and they can't get their cues over the air.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
Well, here's the answer to that.
Work for that.
Yeah.
If you use the 500 or 1000 model of the Barrett's box, right, you have audio going both directions.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use that for communication in your, if you're doing remotes or if you have another studio, right, out like we did or was planned for Viagas. They were going to have a studio on the island where the transmitter is. The main island that's being serviced is a different island, right? So if you have a studio out there, you can bring your audio back, right? Not just to the transmitter from your remote studio.
Mm-hmm.
That doubles the price of the Barrett box if you go to a 500. And let's see, you get, also comes with it is four two-way control channels too.
And like balanced relay controls, you know.
Yeah.
Relay control, and it's balanced, which is the main
right, that's the main advantage of it.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in, and I'm sorry I came late, but I think it was my job to facilitate this a little bit.
Oh, okay, you're the guy.
Really?
I think we'll benefit by hand-raising. you know, as it always happens, once you get past five or six people. So, dealing with latency over internet connections is entirely dependent on protocols used as well as the codecs. Who has seen Amy Goodman do a Skype call with someone on a different continent?
Yeah.
How much is that latency?
Painful. It's a couple seconds.
No more.
Yeah, on a different continent.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, if you drop to using Icecast to connect from Texas to Viroqua, I was running 6-7 seconds delay. But it's because traffic gets treated differently depending on what protocol it is. If you use the right codecs, you can use VoIP protocols that get pushed faster through backbone routers and such.
Yeah, but you lose reliability and quality. So
I disagree.
On average,
quality of
your coffee book. Almost. Okay.
The quality of, say, Opus as a codec is far superior to MP3. And how many people are using MP3 links for stuff? I mean, that's what Comrex uses for crying out loud. And as far as the reliability of it versus Comrex's IP-based stuff, it should be just as good. It's dependent on the quality of the actual internet connection.
Well, yeah.
So, when I originally recommended this, the idea was for people to just throw out 3 or 4 minute descriptions of big projects that they think are probably now possible, but maybe weren't possible 4 or 5 years ago for whatever reason. So, see if people have more of those.
I have a streaming question because we're doing it in television too. Are there in third world and certain dictatorial areas of the world, they don't accept or they block certain routers or I don't even know
port how to protocols.
Yeah, port certain protocols.
Port.
So is it like beneficial to work with more mainstream kind of rather than the mom and pop if you want your show to go to these other, like basically across the world? Because you've talked a lot about staying with mom and pop because it's a reliable.
You can well, that's for short.
For
right.
STL. For STLs. Exactly.
Yeah.
But as far as like getting your stream to
but
be
for a public stream on the internet.
That's a whole different
question.
Thing.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting question. I mean, so there's a couple of different streaming service providers.
Right.
Probably a bunch of them. The question is, who are the most widely non-blocked, I guess. Who are the most widely accepted? I don't know.
You get other possibilities of using alternative ports, and then you've also, if you have control over the streaming server. You can use alternative ports to get the audio to it.
Because I mean, we have
the other thing you could do is use a proxy service.
Yes.
So that's getting encapsulated in a different format, say HTTP packets. Yes, it causes, you know, latency and other things, but it's a way of getting it out of that country.
Todd, you need to explain what you mean by alternative ports. I mean, that's going to be way over some of the people.
Okay, so like IceCast will typically use port 8000.
What is port 8000?
Okay, so with computer networks, different ports are used for different standard protocols. So every time you go to a web page, go ahead.
A port. Think of a port as a channel. It's pretty analogous. Port 80 or channel 80 is usually used for web traffic, HTTP. Secure web traffic usually uses port 443, channel 443. What Todd just said is that IceCast streaming usually uses port 8000. The range, unlike your huge cable system or the FM band. The range of ports is 1 to 65,535. So you have 64 kilobytes, or I'm sorry, not bytes, 64K channels. And there are standard recognized channels like 80, 443. Email travels over port 25. So there are standard recognized versions of these. But in fact, you can run any protocol over any port you want. So you could run a web server on port 6054, or you could run IceCast on port 80.
Okay, well, look, think of a port as a filter, right? That the protocol you run through it, right, is going to get. If that port is designed for that protocol, that's what's going to accommodate it and get it there the best.
No. You can run any protocol on any
port. No, but
you
what
can run
saying
it, right, but you're going to be much more efficient, you're going to have less dropouts.
No. It'll be that your users have to change their software in order to get to this special port. If all of a sudden you're putting some service up at 65,000, then
here we're talking about getting to a server that we're presumably in control of.
Well, no, you're trying to get.
Well,
to
no, I'm
the
saying
public.
Like
we're talking about two different things here, right? We're either talking about running STLs, or we're talking about streaming, and they're two different things.
Right. The question on the table right now is streaming.
Yeah, like we're in Rochester. I mean, so there's all these ports available, but what are the ports, I guess, that are recognized in Somalia or Iran or, you know, because we have a lot of community TV that we have Somali TV, we have, you know, Eritrean, and but then the governments of those countries. You know, like, they want to broadcast to their people back home and stuff like that. They want to put, ideally, shows or radio shows on that is receptive in their regressive communities. What is the most kind of mainstream acceptable international? Well, do you guys know that?
Yeah, so I don't know that any. I don't know that there's any commonality between all those oppressive countries, the governments of those oppressive countries.
Okay.
I think you might be best off using port 80 because it is so universally accepted as web traffic. And you know, some great firewalls may block. They can actually do what's called deep packet inspection, where they can block certain web traffic and not others. But in general, they do superficial blocking at the port level.
Okay.
And so if you did it over port 80, that would probably be your best bet.
Okay.
I'm guessing. I haven't actually analyzed the
And as far as getting your listeners to know that it's on port 80, you can just put that in the web
page.
Right. It's on the web page.
Right.
So.
Yeah, they don't actually have to see port 80. They can just hit the.
Right. They just click the link on your web page and.
Right. Okay.
Some ISPs will block some ports, right? Mm-hmm. That.
It depends on if you're a business customer or a home customer.
Well, that's part of it. But some ports are used to do things that aren't real respective of the net itself, and an ISP will block a port if somebody's figured out how to do it with that.
Right, and it's very unlikely that they'll block port B.
Usually,
because
right?
Otherwise, you couldn't. The way it wouldn't work.
Other project concepts?
I just want to bring up for those stations, even stations that aren't broadcasting yet, but are maybe streaming, that the archive system that Otis McClay developed is really useful. I just introduced you, not worried that you were going to walk in.
I don't know anything about technology.
The archive. Talk about the archive.
Yes,
system
you don't.
They develop.
That's the problem.
The archive?
Yeah.
Ignore everything that man says.
Okay. We've been using it for a long time. I'm one of his bug killers.
He's one of
bug finders, he kills them.
He's one of the most loyal archive users. Do any of you archive now? By archive is
you
a bad
do.
Word. And how do you do it?
I don't have any idea. I'm here recording all of this stuff, and I don't understand anything you're saying. Well, I know we archive. That's what I do now.
Switch your question now.
I just have a question with a comment. I'm pretty sure we have a Barracks box system on our 7,900 watt full power, and that we use a level high enough for the signal to come back, and we grab it, and then it's online.
How do you get it online?
MP3s?
Yeah, but how do you... You can't just tell your listeners there's an MP3 somewhere. I mean, you must have some kind of an interface or something.
Yeah, right. We
to
have
access it.
Yeah, it's just like a... It's just like a database where each MP3 is an object. So, you want to see it?
Actually, it might be interesting. You doing it by hand, or are you doing it...
I don't know. I have to look at the code because I didn't do it, but...
So
we're raising hands here. We just
I was raising a phone. Sorry.
The real word for archiving is time shifting. That's really what's going on. People are not listening, you know, synchronously. They're time shifting.
Okay, so here's the website. Okay, I have a password because I've got.
Well, I'm a listener. How do I get at it?
Well, it's against the law. I mean, if we archive and repeat on the internet, then we're in fact violating copyright.
Okay.
And that can be a significant amount of money. So because we're a music station.
Well, you come under the same rules as streaming. The only difference is you're not allowed to download a music show. You're not allowed to download a podcast, a music show, but you can listen. Now, theoretically, we're supposed to report that as a performance, you know.
Right.
Each of them.
Theoretically, I don't think we want to afford that. But
you're not going to get hammered as long as radio, you know, as long as Sound Exchange has your $500.
So, what
the archive does is just make it really accessible, and it's got, you know, Simon was just showing the version on the on the phone. There.
This is our station, so and Otis just redesigned the whole thing, so you can play. These are most of the music shows.
Oh wow!
And so it goes way back.
So, you know, they store a year of their news.
So you can
they're pulling up there.
You just keep scrolling.
But it loads pretty fast, actually.
Yeah, no, that's
bad.
Cool.
But also go to the top. Go up to the top. You can see the different colors and everything. So you can choose your category.
Okay,
you can choose the show.
Let's
or
focus
you can
on
search.
Things that everyone can talk about at the same time as opposed to showing one person on one phone. Yeah, I think normally something.
Well, I wanted to bring up a different topic, but let me just speak to archiving and Otis's thing. So the way the Digital Millennium Copyright Act works is you can put music shows up on the internet, but they are supposed to be up for no longer than 2 weeks and in lengths of no less than 5 hours. And so you can put your music shows up there for listeners to time shift and listen at a later date. But you're supposed to, under the DMCA, conform to those restrictions along with some other things. And they have to be non-downloadable and so on. So what Otis's software does is it allows you to record all of your station's audio and then chop it into bits by show, so you can have a music show, a news show, whatever, and then make some of those shows downloadable or podcastable, podcasting different downloads that are talk shows, and having the music shows be play only. So Otis has built that system. So that's what Simon is advertising here, is Otis's system, which we use at Ward also. We changed our
modified
the front end of it. Yeah.
What's it called? The system?
I'd love a name, but right now it's just PR5. And Brian DeShazer gets really angry that we're using that word. He owns it. It's automatic. It also has a lot of features. You can put in information about the show so it becomes searchable, and it also makes it possible for the PD to generate the public file by pushing a button instead of spending a week.
To generate the issues and programs list for the public file.
Exactly. Yeah. You push a button and, you know, there it is. That's probably the big thing. And with the advent of HTML5, it becomes very self-contained. You don't have to use M3 units of PLSs to, you know, instantiate a player on your computer.
Are you looking for the address?
So it becomes, what happens with this, and the differences that I've noticed since it's that way, it's really easy to go back and forth. And this also allows you to choose categories, so if somebody just cares about music, they can do that. And there's actually another feature where the copyrighted files are actually hidden. They're supposed to be hidden. They're supposed to be inaccessible from outside.
Where are the actual music files saved? Do they have to be on a server? Could it be like in the cloud or something?
The way this system works, it's all on the server. It's recording the stream on the server, you know, and then it puts it into the archive on the server. It's all on that.
But under federal copyright law, you can't put music shows on the publicly accessible internet where people can download them.
Okay.
So if it's on the server, it should be on the server that's not publicly accessible.
Well, actually, they're above the doc root, and they're for those shows, when we do it, there's a server that delivers them. So the server can see above the doc root, but you can't access it from outside. If you know,
So what is the station you've implemented this at? What is your station?
This is running the archives on PFW, KPFT,
for all
KPFK,
okay. So do you sell WBAI, this?
KMUD, KHOI, and
something source.
A couple of other stations.
Open source?
Running one that they took. It's pretty much open source, so they modified it. We haven't talked for 10 years about it. You know, there's new stuff. It's cool.
Where can we get it?
You talked to me.
So you got it with you now?
Yeah.
You can download it?
I got my laptop across the street.
What
we do, the archive is not something that's, it's not easy to install on a server. If you just have a web page, you know, and you're using, you know, a shared server, a virtual name-based server, you can't really put it up there. It's using tools that big shared servers like that don't allow. So what we do is we have a server, we just got the server, and so we're offering it as a service to people, theoretically to affiliates, although, you know, up to Ursula. Our bottom line is we want to make it work for you. That's really where we're coming.
Other projects we're in the middle of or working on?
So we talked yesterday about this. I think that there's a really good project to be had in traffic software, that everybody is trying to figure out what the hell to do about traffic software in a community radio context. And traffic software being the stuff that you use to create your program logs, and if you do underwriting, track your underwriting spots and so on. There's a lot of commercial products out there, but nothing that is affordable or specifically tailored to the community radio world. And then there's some of the automation programs that generate some portions of traffic lists, but maybe it's not exactly. So I've always thought, and I tried to lean on the folks at Spinitron to see if I could talk them into doing it, but I always thought somebody ought to develop a web-based traffic software for community radio that programmers could log into, that program staff could log into, that could print the necessary reports. So I'm not in a position to write it, but I'm suggesting that that's the project that people are interested in.
I have to say this came up in our underwriting meeting. And what came up was if this underwriting project that Ursula's been working on works, then it's pretty obvious that we're going to have to write traffic software. But one of the nice things I can say is much of the data that's used in that is already there. The schedule is already there. All that information is there.
It's already in there.
Confessing. And also there are other things. HTML5 has kind of opened up printing. It's much more intelligent about printing a web page. So this LAMP form of web-based programming has gotten even more versatile, gotten even more useful.
So when you're saying it's already there, you mean that we've entered the information into the compressor, which then can show it. Compressor is a, maybe you should explain that. For the people who have
that's for reporting copyright. It's another version of Spinitron, or I could say Spinitron's another version of the compressor, but it's a way of recording, recording what you're playing and generating playlists. And it happens that the way we structured it, the compressor holds the schedule. That's where the schedule is. It generates a schedule grid, and stuff like that. There are a lot of APIs, but it has a really cool interface so that you can enter before your show, during your show, after your show. This is all the stuff you were talking about in that meeting.
But for traffic, are you primarily concerned with underwriting announcements?
Well, with the PSAs.
I'm thinking of everything. I'm thinking of underwriting announcements, PSAs, program log. If you're running automation, that would be reflected in there. If you're live DJs, that's reflected in there. It tells you when to run the BBC news headlines, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But to put it in a format where people could see it, use it, update it, and print reports from it.
Yeah, and you start out something like a question. Well, there are advantages to a paper log. You've got the signature. You can do it online. What would really work? What would really be the best kind of tool for a community radio service?
Well, and we've got a huge, there's some number of stations use Spinitron, some number of stations use the Confessor, some number of stations use God knows what. So it seems like you'd want to be able to take data from lots of different places, too.
How does that work when people are mixing music up?
Do you want to know? This is wonderful. You'll enjoy this. You're not allowed to. Sound Exchange.
Over air you are.
No. Yeah, over the air.
Over air.
Sound Exchange sent out a thing because a question came up, how do you record that? And they said, oh, you can't do that.
No mix.
And so, my feeling about a lot of this is the DMCA was written to prevent streaming of music. That was its purpose. Now, the same people, RIAA, want you to stream music because they're getting money. So, where does that leave the DMCA? The DMCA is, 20 years old now, and I don't know if there's ever been a prosecution. I don't know if... Do you do five-hour blocks? You're so good. Nobody else does.
Right.
And, nobody cares, especially because they're getting their play, and they're getting their 50%.
You're saying we can do it, you said, no one cares?
Right. That seems to be the thing. Of course, they can turn around and come after you. If they want to come after you, they'll find something. So I think it's.
You just document it as much as possible, but you don't.
No, I think that reflecting your schedule on the you know, so people can play it later in time sharing, is probably really valuable. And so far, with all of that that we've been doing, we haven't had any problems. And
that's Otis speaking for himself, not on behalf of the Pacifica Radio Network.
Yeah.
And it's why
I can only say, you know, what we've done and what a lot of stations have chosen to do, and what we've done almost without thinking about it. We're not stupid. We know that that's there. But I mean, they wrote the DMCA. It was the first thing they had to do was, holy shit, how are we going to play a symphony? So they had to have a waiver from that. I mean, it's a disaster. It's a meaningless. You can't do requests. You can't play an album. You can't get two cuts in a row. You can't play three of an hour, 2 hours.
More than 2 times.
Yes, you can play two cuts in a row, and you can play three, but they can't be contiguous.
I've seen the radio station do 4 in a row, but they do it 2 on one side of the hour and 2 on the other.
I don't think so.
Well, this is the thing. Radio stations aren't held to these rules.
Oh,
this is just streaming.
Yeah. I'm saying that the people who forced us into that now want us to play their stuff.
Right.
So everything has shifted.
So I've got another one. Totally different direction. I talked with a few of you about this at some point or another. When trying to get these no interference zones for low power FMs, Mike and other people signed us up for doing a lot of very difficult antennas. Usually
I'm
two
sorry.
Bays, three bays, four bays. Mike did the best he could with the tools at hand. But to me, not knowing very well, you know, exactly what's involved in it, it seems like it's a problem that no one really had before, was trying to get a low-power station to prevent itself from having a 30-meter or 40-meter, strong signal strength zone. And I think there must be a way, without building, like, a four-bay antenna, to build an antenna that will not send energy down towards the ground, whether it's putting chicken wire all over the roof underneath it or making something radically different shape, turning them upside down, turning them sideways. I think there's got to be a better antenna that would be something that, instead of having four bays, you know, you could put it on your roof. It's like the size of a common antenna, but it just shoots all of its energy straight out to the ground.
Okay, what it is a series of log periodics, three or four of them, to sort of semi-simulate an omelet.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's been done.
Oh,
a long log periodic gives you the elevation pattern. Maybe a three bay antenna.
I did raise my hand.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Regarding that, what Mike was mentioning is something that you can do now if you have lots of money. And I know what you're asking for is think about the future and what else we can do. I've had a couple of thoughts. One of them, I mean, as a starting point, is a series of log periodics or panels like we're talking about. But the question is, how can we get the cost down and can we make them? Because the we can get a single bay circular polarized LPFM antenna at a reasonable price. As soon as you start to go multi-bay and the multiple log periodics, even though they're not stacked this way, the effect is really equivalent of multi-bay in the sense of the problem that you have raised.
Although the biggest thing is having to go high.
Right.
I mean,
right,
it doesn't matter
right.
if you have a lot of
right.
horizontal.
So I have a couple of questions there. One is that since a single bay is cheap enough, but once you get into multi-bays and these special ones, now you're driving the price up. One comment is that you can make your own power divider. I mean, part of the cost of a multi-bay antenna is the power divider. Power divider is something that splits the power between the two bays.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you got, all right, I'm not going to, $400 for a single bay antenna, I'm not going to argue with that, that's fine. Now, as soon as you go to the multi-bay antenna, you add the second bay, you also add the power divider. And all right, so you got the extra $400 for the second bay, but then there's the $2,000 for the power divider. And that one is easy because I know how to make a power divider out of coax. That's very simple to make and cheap, and that can save some money. And but leading on a little bit further is that is how to get is a cheaper log periodic. I have another question, and that is, let me ask you about that crazy helical antenna that you have out in Portland. That's the broadband one that you feed all those different stations into.
Yeah.
Now, my question is, I'm curious about the design of the antenna, and can we make at a low cost an antenna of that type of design that is comparably priced to the single bay rototiller or penetrator type that we use ordinarily, except that it would sit up on top of the mast and go up a few and be of that type of design and make one of those at a price that's affordable, because that would accomplish what Petrie was asking about.
Well, the beauty of that kind of antenna is it's amazingly circular. It's within like 0.2 dB of a perfect circularity, which nobody can touch.
Yeah.
Any other kind of design.
Yeah.
But it's 90 feet tall, and it's the equivalent of about a 6-bay antenna. And so it really doesn't save any vertical space on your tower.
That particular one is, but I'm thinking of studying the design of that and making an antenna that uses that type of design. A couple of spirals of it, and it can be done in different.
But it doesn't give you that pattern advantage versus tower space occupied. There's not really much advantage there. Its big advantage is circularity and bandwidth, very wide band.
I understand that, but if we could make such a unit that would mount on top, because that mounts on top.
That's true.
It might make it might help with the problem.
Well,
depending on how you look at it.
Here's the thing I've started to work on, but haven't gotten very far. It's called a binomial feed, essentially where you're feeding unequal amounts of power to the individual bays. You can do it with as few as 3 bays. You can space bays as close as a halfway ring apart from each other. Using a binomial, there are some of these second adjacent waivers that were just impossible. Nobody could do them unless they were on a very tall tower. And what my goal is to get the equivalent of like a 6-bay or a 7-bay out of a 3-bay. Mm. And that's what I've been working on. And I've got the software on a spreadsheet to be able to figure this all out. I just have to spend the time to do it. But beyond that, if you want to get, you know, the equivalent of a 3-bay in a single elevation, you pretty much have to go long, long periodics. And you could build your own long periodics. They're big and heavy. Unfortunately, their frequencies are low enough that they end up being quite large, you know. The most popular CLFM Scala antenna is like 9 feet long, 8 feet long, with 10 elements, as I recall. So,
But actually,
they have to be kind of that large, and that means a big chunk of metal, you know.
I'm not convinced that. Well, so what's
the solution? I don't know.
No, what's the one that you're talking about with the...
The binomial feed?
You mean the unequal feed.
Oh, the I would use conventional antennas.
Yeah.
But 3 bays and get the equivalent of 4, 5, 6 bays or more. You can get extremely tight patterns so we can do some of these really impossible second adjacent frequencies we haven't been able to use.
By feeding them unequally?
Yeah.
And you can play around with that and
basically get what... There's actually a couple manufacturers that are marketing variations of this called side-load-free antenna.
Regarding the cost, because the real bottom line here is controlling the cost.
whatever and cost.
Yeah, I don't know.
And the buildability. I mean, it's one thing to spend money, but you just might not be able to get on a rooftop.
Yeah, but that's all cost. I mean,
well, but it's also permanent.
Yeah.
You know, there are some places they won't allow you to build something.
Yeah,
like
right,
well.
Right.
But this using arrays of log periodics, this is actually done more commonly in Europe.
Yeah.
We're seeing full power stations that are using, you know, like 20 log periodics splayed out every 90 degrees and multiple stations sharing it, and that's how they do it. So, interesting.
Actually, when you think about some of these LPFMs that are on rooftops, mm-hmm. The ring of log periodics mm-hmm. does start to make sense because you have all this roof area, mm-hmm. And it's not, and if the goal is to get it down closer and.
But you can't easily do a radome on a log in temp. That's the problem. So that's why I think it's.
The first translator that came out, or Gray Hartig built for KMUD, had these long periodics, and it was in an area where there's a lot of ice falling from up above, and these things were beat. They worked really well.
Actually, WGXC's log periodics have radomes. Mm-hmm.
Over the whole thing, or just over the ribbon element? Or
it's not a big thing over the whole thing, but there's sections of it that are covered.
Hmm. Well, actually, log periodics, it's all active elements. It's not unlike a Yagi where you really only have one arm that's driven.
But the thing about needing the about the concern for the ice is that it detunes it.
Yeah.
And if it's broadband, detuning it is not so much of a problem. Mm-hmm.
In Puerto Rico, we use a slant log to sort of simulate circular polarization. What you actually end up is more horizontal than vertical, but that's okay with us. And it worked amazingly well, but that was a tight directional in that particular case. So
I wonder what it would take to make plans by which you could buy some copper tubing at Home Depot or Lowe's or whatever, and make your own log periodics.
It's all, they usually make it out of aluminum aluminum channel and aluminum rod.
Yeah, well,
so
whatever, but what I'm getting at is they usually make it out of stuff that can be bought fairly cheaply.
Yeah, you can make your own.
And have
probably a couple $100 or less worth of materials.
And have published plans to make them.
It's a lot of drilling.
Yeah.
A lot of drilling and tapping. And
that's what CNC milling machines are for.
Yeah.
I have access.
Laser cutting machine.
Well,
have you ever done one like that? Built the antenna for any of the horn readings?
Not in the United States. I mean, we're always building dipoles and like basic, you know, 5/8 ground plane sorts of antennas, but never a lot of periodic.
I'm just curious.
I give it a try.
I've actually made the homemade power dividers for some for installation.
And how much scalping are you willing to accept? I mean, sometimes they use as few as three, but really to get something less than 4 or 5 or 6 nulls, you need to use 4 of them.
Well, it depends.
Yeah. But anyway. I haven't done it because the commercially available long periodics were like a grand a piece. And yeah.
All right.
Well,
a grand a piece
on that one,
or up to
for each one,
or whatever.
On that one, if someone has a suggestion, I'll try building one.
I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
No way.
I actually in Philadelphia, we have like a little antenna study group lately where we're just trying out different building antennas and trying to learn a little bit more about how to test them. We don't have all the equipment that you need to do it rigorously or intelligently, but we're trying to ramp up to the point where we will. So I mean, the thing I'd love to be able to do is, like, to be able to build them and then actually measure how well they're doing, which is...
That's actually not hard.
Yeah.
Measuring how well they're doing in a practical sense, like you're talking about, making absolute measurements is much more difficult than making relative measurements.
Yeah.
And so if you have a reference, and if you're not going for like FCC approval, you just want to know if this is better than this and how much better it is, that's a lot easier to do.
Do antennas scale? So if you put like half a watt into an antenna and then measure the output of that, would that scale to putting in 100 watts?
No.
What?
No, it doesn't. Because the SWR changes. Because the power changes.
No, SWR doesn't change with power. It's linear.
I would think that it's regardless of power unless you're getting...
No, SWR doesn't change with power. If you have an antenna with 6 dB gain, it has 6 dB gain.
You mean what percentage change?
Well, 6 dB decibels is ratio.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, they scale. Now, the issue here, in fact, when they measure antennas on a test range, they measure them at low power, because if they measure them at full power, they'd interfere with everybody. If you look at the antenna test ranges that the manufacturers
use, right.
You go out in the yard, and you set up an antenna, and you set your antenna on your test and your receive antenna, and you put it on the frequency you're going to use. You don't worry about it interfering with somebody because you run it at such low power that it won't.
Actually, on test ranges, they often build everything like a quarter
size,
and they double or quadruple the frequency.
Yeah, build models.
Which I am blown away that actually works.
I'm not in math, and
increases cost of the antenna tremendously.
Sure. Well, actually, the point, considering, if it truly increased the cost of the antenna, they wouldn't do it.
To use the scale models?
Yeah. I only has to put up a test model for you. Now, this is for directional antennas where you've got to accomplish a particular thing.
I like the idea because, in theory, if you've ever been on a test range, unless you're looking over their shoulder, they'll turn the turntable only enough times so they can make it meet basic specs.
Well,
and not go further than that.
There's one particular guy in Michigan that makes antennas and has been known for cheating a lot. He's got a bunch of directional antennas that he made himself for his own Smile FM network, and I don't trust any of them.
But when you do scale models, instead of sending a guy up a tower or up a cherry picker, they can just stand on a ladder. One guy can do the work of two or three. So in theory, at least, they can spend more time tweaking the pattern and less time sending guys up and down.
Which means Which means if we're doing experimenting, you can experiment with scale models.
Yeah.
And the bit about really you need a signal generator and a calibrated receiver. Mm-hmm. And that is actually not hard to do. In fact, I'll say been there, done that.
Does software-defined radio help you with that?
No.
Oh, cool. That's something.
Just a point of clarification or questioning. So the way to enter, you were saying that it would be ideal if it wouldn't, the antenna wouldn't transmit the signal immediately to the immediate space around it, causing distortion and all that.
Right. Yeah, what the limitations are all about at this point, and what people have did hundreds and hundreds of ridiculous hours of work to prevent, is this effect where, like, right around the antenna, let's call it light bulbs instead of antennas, and it's really obvious. If you took, like, a little 5-watt light bulb and you put it right next to your eye, wow, that's really blinding. which looks like out here, it's no problem. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with antennas. Like if you have a 10,000 watt transmitter, it has like a what's called a blanketing area, which causes interference for about a mile around it.
How does that multipath? Because it's so powerful, it bounces off stuff.
Yeah.
Well, bouncing, but it's the blanketing
interference.
So there's
no material that absorbs that.
The blanketing interference is the issue.
Yeah.
What's the definition
but
of
even
blanketing
if you have
interference?
Let me just finish the explanation. So if you have 100 watt, it's really not that big a deal. It's only like 30 feet, 100 feet, something like that. But the FCC has very strictly regulated that so that no person can be anywhere near that. So if you want to put an antenna on a rooftop in a city, which is where we can finally build low-power FMs, you have to somehow assure them that your antenna's very, very strong signal strength area is not going to reach the people on the sixth floor of the building where you're putting the antenna. Mm-hmm. And the only way we know to do that so far is to build a really tall tower on top of the building so it doesn't reach that 30 feet, 50 feet, or put an antenna that, like, compresses the signal and sends it out rather than sending it down. So that's the problem that we're talking
about. What about something like what Google's doing with the helium? I know helium's expensive, but couldn't you string up a helium balloon and attach antennas to it?
Antennas tend to be heavy at FM. In fact, those are kind of large. So they take a lot of helium.
Yeah. Seems. What is Google doing with this?
Apparently, they're in Africa or wherever. Wi-Fi. They're
putting Wi-Fi antennas up.
Hot air balloons up, or I don't know, some type of balloons.
Not hot air. I can imagine all kinds of failure modes.
Yeah.
I can imagine that you might put up something like that for a temporary.
Yeah. For a festival or something.
For a festival or
but not permanent.
Or a catastrophe or something like that.
In Africa. No, even in Africa, I could expect. I would expect that they. It might anywhere. I would expect you might put up something like that temporary, but I wouldn't expect it to last.
Is the issue below the antenna primarily a health issue or interference?
Interference. There's also health issues.
Only
13 feet.
For those who don't know, the definition. What is blanketing interference? That was the question that was asked. Blanketing interference is that the signal is so strong that the radio receiver has trouble rejecting it even though it's not tuned to it. And you get this when you're so close to the transmitting antenna that the station seems to come in everywhere.
It's 115 dB, I think?
FCC definition, but the practical definition of what it means is that it just seems to wipe out the band. It's so strong that you can't really get anything else.
Can't change channels.
You can't change channels.
You pick it up in your
teeth. And in the extreme case, if the station comes in everywhere, when you're getting close to that, you could have a situation where the radio is desensitized, where it just seems that everything else is weaker because this so strong signal is there. But it's in the like 100 over 100 dB signal thing. Very close.
Related. And what were you saying with the water in Puerto Rico? What was it doing? Or you had to curve something around?
That was microwave.
Okay. Well, it's always a little bit nervous time when you shoot a microwave over long bodies of water. Mm-hmm. But I think what helps is that ocean is almost never calm and glassy.
So what Norm was saying,
and if that happens maybe once a year for a few hours, maybe. So it's probably a bigger problem over large lakes, perhaps.
Right. What Norm was saying, they're stationed in Madison, shoots over a significant size body of water, a lake, but it's still just a lake, and so that the water can get really calm. And apparently, I don't know about
it. But again, if it happens to, it could actually get to the point where. If the geometry is just right, it completely cancels out the signal, and they get almost no received signal strength at the other end.
I'm just noticing.
And then your signal drops out, and you're off the air.
Hey, I've got one more for the computer guys around. I think at this point, we're probably close to the point where a Raspberry Pi or something like that could be your compressor limiter. If you could, like, just if someone wrote like a little piece of code that could sit on a tiny little chip, that could you could make something that took into account the preemphasis curve and did multiband, you know, multiband limiting, and you know, cost you know $40-$50 plus you know putting the software on it.
Whether it's Raspberry Pi,
Emily for his master's, his doctoral thesis.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big job.
The technical service pumping awesome. It's an amazing piece of software.
Is it open source?
Probably not.
Not if it runs on Winamp.
I'll look for it.
But Winamp's been discontinued, so.
But Winamp itself is an open source, so how are you going
to find it and there's send it to you?
The plugins can be run in some of the Linux utilities.
Yeah.
The
you could get into serious trouble with it.
Well, since Winamp is discontinued and the company is
here,
but
you
can
still
get
it.
You can still get it. But what I'm saying, well, how does that deal
it's
with?
It's harder than you think.
Well, you know, open source versus not.
Well,
and what
they still retain
the rights.
They still
retain
the rights.
Hey, I'm sorry, everybody. One at a time.
So what you're saying though is, sure, software might exist, but how would you take it from that form and put it in an FPGA, for example?
That would be it.
I mean, that's the challenge, is to get it into that form.
The good news is that now the signal processor, the graphical signal processor, is available in the Raspberry Pi. So, and people have written FFT routines that run on that. And in the Raspberry Pi, the amount of power that's for the main processor is small. But the amount of processing power that's in the graphic GPU is huge. So the idea of doing that kind of signal processing in that package makes a lot of sense.
There's a Windows program for it's called Stereo Tool. There's a free version and then there's a paid version.
If it doesn't exist, this could easily be written as a C Labs plugin.
See what?
C-Ladspa. They're universal plugins for audio filtering and stuff like that. Those plugins are used on Windows software, Linux software.
Can you spell C-Ladspa?
C-L-A-D-S-P-A.
Oh. Yeah, there are actually a bunch of multi-band compressors. This thing is a... He has a compressor, expander, they're all multi-band, brick wall limiter.
Yeah, I wouldn't actually, I'd be surprised if it wasn't.
But a bunch of multi-band compressors.
I love it.
And what was the, when you were talking about?
Wave snakes. And
well, what was the...
I'm trying to remember the name. I'll send it to you.
Okay.